all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense for this Friday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, and it's a beautiful day on Lake Wissota, albeit a bit chilly, a little windy, and we'll get a full update from weatherology coming up in the next hour here. Jennifer Wyszytski will join us. Aaron Zommers joins us now as we say good morning from Chippewa Falls and from Madison as we look ahead to a busy morning ahead of the weekend. Mr. Zommers, how are you?
Doing pretty well. The ice on my windshield was definitely belligerent this morning.
Was belligerent. Ooh, I like that. I've never heard ice described quite that way, but that works out. Coming up this morning, there is a climate for investing in cleaner energy. And in a few minutes here, we'll talk to Justin Warland, a Washington, D.C.-based senior correspondent for Time, who covers climate change politics and policy, about his recent Wisconsin visit to discuss the potential found in the new Inflation Reduction Act. And then, if you're watching on Facebook live video, you see our usual stable of Friday guests there. We'll talk at 6:30 with Kia Vakil, national correspondent for Courier Newsroom, Mark Jacob, a former editor at the Chicago Tribune and Chicago Sun-Times, will help us look at how the media has covered the headlines of the past week, and Dan Schumacher will join us to talk about weekend sports that are coming up, and we'll have a little update on that for you as well. Yes, you're noticing correctly that your host did not dress in green, and whereas Mr. Zommers did. Although is that the most Irish Mountain Dew shirt that you could find?
I think so, but don't worry, I'm also wearing green socks and green underwear. Now you know.
I didn't need to know that, but thank you. Appreciate that so much. Sure, I'll go with that. I've got something green on, and we'll leave it at that. But again, there's some Green Bay Packer gear laying around someplace, but you know, I come to realize every year there's just not much green in the Kreitlow wardrobe, in the color palette, for whatever reason that might be. But I'm sure that there will be a lot of other folks who are out celebrating and probably sharing memories of celebrations that were abbreviated or canceled 3 years ago today, when COVID-19 truly seemed to hit Wisconsin. The shutdown order came that afternoon before the bars could fill up and before more people could get sick. Were you up in the Manitowoc area at that point, Aaron, or where were you back in 2020?
Yes, I would have been in Manitowoc.
Okay. Yeah, and there's a few watering holes there that did not see any business that day, and it was a big change for everybody.
Yeah, I wasn't planning to go out anyway just because of everything that had been happening. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it definitely, it was a very different year.
I've told the story already that day we talked to some neighbors. We stood far apart from each other. And, the rumor at the time was that this thing, this COVID-19 could, this could kill 50,000 people in the U.S. And nobody wanted to believe it. And somebody said to my wife, who's a physician, saying, "You don't really think it could kill 50,000 people, do you?" And she said, Yeah, I really think it could. And then after we left, as we were walking away, she said to me, "This thing's going to kill at least 100,000 people. And the current death toll in the U.S. is 1,100,000 people." So it did kill 100,000 people, and then did so again and again and again, till we have a death toll of 1.1 million. And so much of it got started 3 years ago today, when it really came home and we saw the potential for the damage that it could do. And we then started to see the pushback and the denialism, which I think has claimed an untold number of lives. We'd like to know your thoughts on the anniversary of COVID and what you remember from that day, and what are your thoughts going forward. Our studio line number is 844-967-2789. And the number for our Up North line, 715-388-7155. Both get you to Mr. Zommers, who will take your call and put you on hold for us. You can also email us, radio@upnorthnewswi.com. And upnorthnewswi.com is where you'll find the work that our Up North News reporters are doing all the time, or you can find us on social media. Just search for Up North News WI. And of course, a lot of our coverage is about the state Supreme Court race, which is now in 18 days. So just keep that in mind that 18 days from now, we're going to need folks to be at their voting booths or have that sense of satisfaction that you have mailed in your absentee ballot. And if you need to find out more about absentee voting, in-person absentee voting, where your polling place is, or what's on your ballot, go to myvote.wi.gov. Get that information and be sure to vote. Because, look, more people than ever are paying attention to this race, and we'll certainly be talking to Kia Vakil about that coming up at the bottom of the hour. But even so, despite all the extra attention, there are still plenty of folks who aren't going to vote in this unless they hear more about it over the coming days, until they hear the stakes that are out there. And if you were listening yesterday, you heard our interview with Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz, one of the two candidates on the ballot on April 4th. We had also reached out to the campaign of conservative former Justice Dan Kelly as well, inviting him to do an interview. But as Justice Protasiewicz put it so well, there is just so much that is on the line in this one single election. Most notably for most folks, women's health care rights and the state's 1849 abortion ban, but also issues about free and fair elections. Kia Vakil will talk to us more about the 1849 abortion ban because he has a new article coming to UpNorthNewsWI.com about everything that is different since 1849, except for this abortion ban, which is still in effect. But coming up next, we will talk to Justin Warland. I talked to him yesterday as he was in Wisconsin for a talk about climate change politics and policy and the new Inflation Reduction Act. We'll have that interview right after this break. This is Up North News Radio for a Friday.
Beautiful Wisconsin, nature's wonderland, in all.
Justin Warland is a Washington, D.C.-based senior correspondent for Time magazine covering climate change and the intersection of policy, politics, and society, something that he's been doing now for the past 7-8 years. Justin, thank you for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
In making these remarks in Wisconsin about the Inflation Reduction Act and the entire clean energy shift, you normally are on panels, and so you'll talk for 5 minutes, you'll answer some questions. This time around, as a keynote speaker, you got a little bit of extra time to talk to this Wisconsin audience. So when you get a chance to do that, what is the main message or a couple of messages you always want to make sure you deliver when you're talking about this worldwide shift to cleaner energy sources?
Yeah, well, I think there are really three things that I would say are my key points, all of which, of course, are related. One is you know, that there's immense opportunity from the Inflation Reduction Act, but more broadly from this global transition to clean energy and to a clean economy. And so we all should be thinking about, you know, how do we take advantage of those? What is our role in that transition? Second thing is that there are really big challenges. And so I think it's really important to be clear-eyed about, you know, the fact that while this is a good thing and there's opportunity, that it's going to be hard. And so I talked a bit about those challenges. And then I think the final point is I always want people to think about the extent to which this stretches, right? That this is not just about, you know, solar panels and wind turbines, though it is about those things. This is about things that stretch into all of our lives, that are going to change the way we work, the way we live, and just to challenge people to really open their minds to that. And so those were, I guess, three critical points that I made.
When we've talked about this issue previously, I've taken an interest in the way that the conversation has shifted, or maybe it's better to say that it's expanded, because previously it was all about essentially the climate, the moral case, the altruism that's involved. Now you're putting some real money behind this, opportunity, innovation, and what have you. And I wonder about your own impressions of the way this whole thing has gone from just a debate to a debate and financial opportunities.
Well, I think it's huge, right? I mean, I think there's a reason why you see President Biden and why you see officials in Washington and around the world really talk about all of this in the language of opportunity, right? Because that's a lot more appealing to the average person than talking about the doom and gloom of climate disasters. And so I think it's quite a revolutionary shift, and I think you're right to point it out. There's a few things that I always say. I mean, Wisconsin clearly is a place that's pretty well situated. If you think about the effects of climate change, you're not going to face devastating heat or floods, et cetera. At least not in the same way other places are. But you know, no place is an island, right? And so you start thinking about what does it mean if people are migrating and looking for, you know, safer places to live. How will that stress Wisconsin's economy? What are the challenges there? So I think it's important to keep those in mind too. But I think, you know, overall, absolutely, opportunity is changing the way people talk about it, and it's real. It's a big deal.
What kinds of questions do you get from panel discussions and things like this? As I tried to anticipate some of them, I wondered, the Inflation Reduction Act, for example, is a very large package. I'm sure to some people it doesn't look nearly large enough for the problem, but you also have a political faction that, you know, looks at anything and says we are spending far too much. As you look at it from, you know, your standpoint as a correspondent on this issue, are the things that are in the Inflation Reduction Act, the size, the various targets for it, is it something that can make progress, or in your own view, did it come out of the oven too soon and you know could be baked a bit better?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I won't take a position on, you know, like what should it have looked like. I mean, I try to sort of just look at it with the clear eye. I think clearly this is a huge deal. You know, $370 billion on paper, but if you look at the actual sort of, you know, line items, you know, there are things like, I always talk about the $5 billion line item, you know, $5 billion and 370, that gives the Department of Energy's Loan Program Office the ability to write $250 billion in loans, right? And so you just look at some of these provisions, which seem relatively small from the outset, are actually huge. And I think, you know, so where does that get us in terms of climate? You know, the analysis is that, you know, when you consider the Inflation Reduction Act, the bipartisan infrastructure law, and what they do to the curve of emissions, maybe it brings emissions down 40% by 2030 from 2005 levels. You know, the Biden administration's goal is 50%. You know, so it's getting us almost there.
I'm sure a lot of your visit here was dealing with folks that, from a business standpoint, they're wondering, is it worth it? Do you have to be a mega, you know, in industry, a great big utility for this to mean something? Or is this truly a case where there are a balance of business as well as individual homeowner driver investments that can be made? Are there things that a typical Wisconsin business should be or could be looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are things in here for everyone. I mean, you know, down from the sort of, as you alluded to, energy retrofits, weatherizing your home. These are things that, you know, can be several thousands, perhaps a little over $10,000 for some people. These are things that, you know, everyday homeowners, taxpayers, et cetera, could be thinking about taking advantage of. There are some programs that target smaller businesses. And of course, a lot of the way that smaller businesses will feel the effects of this is through their interactions with larger businesses, right? So if you're in the supply chain of a large business, or you're doing business with consumers who are now buying the low carbon product, et cetera. But at all scales, I mean, you know, you talk to people who are trying to apply for those, say, multi-billion dollar loans, the companies that are trying to do that, it's complicated. It's a lot of work, it's hard. And I think that is one of the challenges, right? Like, this is a big opportunity, but you have to figure out how to implement it, how to get people to have the awareness about how to take advantage of the tax credits and the various programs. And I think that's still an open question about how that's going to all play out. As you said, people were really asking about that at this session. And I think the big answer is this law passed in August of last year. It is really complicated. the agencies, you know, from Treasury to Energy to EPA to, you know, across the administration, are figuring out those details. And hopefully we'll start to get some clarity soon that will really give people confidence. But there's something in there for everybody. We just got to make sure people know that and understand how to take advantage.
I really jumped into the investments and the opportunity and the economic end of this. And I'm sure some folks would say I blew right past the discussion or the debate, if you will. I have no doubt that you get stopped by people, if not professionally, then personally, privately, that want to give you either the, you know, the hoax line or something else. And I just have to ask, for somebody as deep into this and knowledgeable as you, when you get those points brought up to you, do you find a way to engage and find a productive conversation that results? Or are you now at the point where you look at them and do you just go, come on, man, why are we still talking about this as a debate? How do you deal with that?
It's a good question. And I think there's sort of like almost a binary. You sort of get a sense just in talking to somebody, whether they're, you know, acting in good faith, whether they're somebody who actually wants to engage and have a conversation. And if somebody does, then I'm all ears, and I would love to have that conversation. And in fact, I've had some, you know, email chains with people that have stretched, you know, months, where we'll go back and forth and they're engaging in good faith and I'm trying to answer questions and take what they say seriously. And there are other times when people are aggressive and they say, oh, it's a hoax and you're, you know, the lying liberal media. And at that point, you know, you can kind of say, well, thank you for, you know, for coming and spending your day to come and tell me that, you know, to make that point, I hope that was a good use of your time and the conversation's over. But I think it's really about feeling people out, because there are people who are just genuinely wanting to understand better. And I think it's important to talk to those people seriously.
Whether it's skeptics or just policymakers who drag their feet, if there were one place on earth where you could show them and help them understand how real this is and how it's affecting people, or it's affecting, you know, natural resources or what have you, where would you point them to?
Well, it's a challenging question. I think I would say I would have to point, and it's maybe the obvious answer, to some of the Pacific Islands. And you know, I went out in 2019 to an island in Fiji, where they had relocated a village, and you could sort of see the effects of sea level rise firsthand, and you get a sense of how real that challenge is. But I think the more important thing that came out of that trip for me, and I think would resonate with people if they could see this, is that it's not just about moving the village. It's also about what did that move mean for the education of the children in the village? What did it mean for local efforts at economic development? You know, if they could no longer rely on the same industries that they used to, and you start to see that this is such an all-encompassing problem. And I hope a lot of people, I mean, sometimes you'll hear people who say, well, that's sad for them, but, you know, we live in Wisconsin and it's great, but the world is not an island. You know, there are canaries in the coal mine. And I think if people can wrap their head around that, they might just understand the scale of this problem a little more.
And then the last thing is what gives you, you know, either a sense of hope for progress, or what do you see that just really excites you in terms of, maybe it's leadership, it might be a person, it might be the collective thinking of a particular country and embracing this, it might be a particular inventor or idea. But when you have your best days thinking about the future of this transition, what kinds of things do you think about?
Well, I think two things. You know, this is a depressing beat, but there are things to be happy and excited and optimistic about. And so I got two things. I mean, one is just, you know, you look at in the time that I've been doing this, as you said, you know, eight years or so, the scale of the change of the energy transition, it is real. You can see it. You can see it on the ground. You can travel across the country and go to places where multi-billion-dollar investments are happening, where new jobs are being created, where you sort of see this possibility of a different clean economy. And it's, you know, it's not one particular place, it's everywhere. So you have to look for those little green shoots. The other thing I would say, you know, And it kind of pairs with that trip to Fiji I mentioned. You know, I travel sometimes to communities that are really struggling, and sometimes I get the question of, you know, how depressing must that be? And you know, it is clearly very sad. But I think what I'm often struck by is in many communities you see a sense of resilience, a sense of, you know, how can we take the situation that we're in that's pretty bad and make it better? And I think with climate change more broadly, the situation is really bad, but we have to look for ways in which we can all be resilient. And I think finding those stories is really important.
And that again was Justin Warland. He's a senior correspondent with Time Magazine covering climate change, policy, and politics. And he spoke yesterday at a WISP Politics and WISPBusiness.com and Milwaukee Press Club event. Kia Vakil is coming up next. You're up north. Back now on Up North News Radio, and as we do every week at this time, we talk to Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kia Vakil, who's out on the West Coast, where I got to see him live and in person. Fortunately, most of our time was indoors, and we had a great time, and so we decided to wait till now when we're back in the shelter of our respective home offices, as it were, and can get into some of the headlines of things that have taken place this week. And as we like to do, we start by highlighting something that Kia is working on for Up North News. And that would include an article about the 1849 abortion ban, not so much about the abortion ban part of it, but the 1849 part of it. And, you know, what else was around in 1849 besides a law that now controls women's bodies? You came up with a very impressive list.
Yeah. So, you know, it turns out that life was very different 174 years ago when this ban was passed that takes away reproductive freedom from women in Wisconsin in 2023. You know, in 1849, which was 140 some years before I was born, children often died before they turned five. It's pretty wild, but the numbers are 22% of white children and 34% of black children died before the age of five. The difference in that percentage is pretty attributable to the fact that, you know, slavery was legal. And in general, people died young. The average life expectancy was under 40 years old. People died from drinking milk because it wasn't pasteurized and diseases spread. Diarrhea could kill you. So it was a pretty grim time to be alive. And yet, you know, women living today are under restrictions from a law that was passed at a time like that.
Decades before they had the right to vote, you know, decades of just white guys voting and controlling women and controlling other adult human beings. And that's, you know, that control is really, it's at the heart of all this. And so look for Kia's article over at upnorthnewswi.com or on social media. But it does, again, underscore that the Wisconsin Supreme Court election not only will determine abortion rights in Wisconsin and perhaps be a harbinger for the rest of the country, but it is a race that continues to get immense national attention and national funding. And Kia, that's only ramping up as we're now here with, 18 days until the election.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing more and more money pour in. You know, Janet's campaign has raised a lot and they've spent a lot. Dan Kelly's campaign has not spent a dime on ads last time I checked, which I don't believe has changed since yesterday, but I, you know, can't quote me on that. But he has plenty of backers from, you know, rich right-wing donors to, you know, business interests in Wisconsin. So, you know, he has a chance at this thing. And
he's referred to it as the cavalry. You know, he's all but saying, I'm not going to lift a finger. You know, other people can do the work for me, which, yeah, of course they will. But God, what does that say to voters? You know, that.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you look at who's backing him and it's the typical group of Republican backed, you know, billionaires, business interests who just want lower taxes and, you know, to gut workers' rights. Obviously, you know, Dick and Elizabeth Uihlein are pretty ideological, extremely far right. They support election deniers who tried to overturn 2020, including Dan Kelly, who advised on overturning 2020 with Republicans in Wisconsin. And I might add, got paid $120,000 to do that, which is more than almost anyone I know makes in Wisconsin and outside of it. And yeah, so that those special interests are backing Kelly, and you have to ask why. And clearly the answer is because they think he will rule in their interest and in their favor.
Yeah, and somebody who is going up against Janet Protasiewicz, who has said she will recuse herself if Democratic Party cases come up before her, simply because the Democratic Party has invested so much funding into promoting her campaign. So again, I can't emphasize enough, this is really a battle between tune out and turn out. And we are squarely on the side of turnout wherever you sit on this. This is not any kind of an election that you should be sitting out. There are immense stakes that are involved in this, and we'll continue to talk about them throughout the these final couple of weeks of the contest. All right, let's turn to some other national goings on this week. A lot of little things here and there in terms of Congress trying to ramp up some of its activity, or at least the rhetoric about what it might do for activity. And the signs are still there that a group of Republicans who loved to talk during the election campaign about inflation and the cost of living and how tough things are for the American family, they sure don't have a problem raising the costs on folks who rely on assistance for everything from their healthcare to their food.
Yeah. So there is this not, it's a big wing of House Republicans, you know, who are the most conservative, the most extreme, you might want to call them MAGA Republicans. They have introduced, you know, a vision of America, a blueprint that would effectively gut food stamps, also known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's just money to help working class and low-income people afford food at grocery stores so that their kids don't go hungry. They want to cut that spending by an astronaut. Like, I think it's more than half the last time I checked on their plan. And that's a huge amount. You know, there are plans that would eliminate the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansion, which I know Wisconsin has not passed, but you know, we're going on 40 states that have, and that's would take away health insurance from 21 million Americans. They want to repeal the Inflation Reduction Act, which would take away subsidies for Affordable Care Act insurance. It would raise prescription drug costs for seniors. There's been talk of slashing housing assistance by 43%. So, you know, this sounds like comically evil. And I think a problem that we have a lot in politics is a lot of Republican plans sound so crazy that people just don't believe them, and they think they're just Democratic attack ads. But there's a document, like there is a 104-page document that lays out this plan. And I want to be clear, the specific proposal the House Freedom Caucus introduced on Friday is a little different from this, but it has a lot of the same elements. Some are not quite there, but they're all the same thing to effectively gut spending that helps poor Americans survive and not die.
Well, that's where their priority is right now. Here's where their priority is not: investigating Donald Trump and the things that he did. One of the headlines this week was that House Republicans have quietly halted a congressional investigation into whether Trump profited improperly from the presidency. And I'll tell you, the guy that really takes the cake, and I still don't think he's getting nearly enough attention for just the shameless amount of hypocrisy, is this congressman from Kentucky, James Comer, who is the chair of the Oversight Committee, who professed ignorance about, you know, the Trump inquiry that Democrats were doing, saying, I didn't know anything about it. He said, they've been investigating Trump for 6 years. I know what I'm investigating. I'm investigating the money that the Bidens received from China, which it isn't a thing, but this is where the priorities are in the House of Representatives these days.
Yeah. And because, you know, you'll notice they don't exactly defend Trump. It's a whataboutism to China or Biden, which is not, again, like you said, not a thing. And the reason there's been 6 years of investigations into Trump is because he's been doing crimes for 6 years. Or passing or trying to take illegal actions when he was president. You know, people, I'm not going to pretend like the American justice system is perfect. It's not. You could argue reasonably, you know, not James Comer because he doesn't do that. But there are people who could have rational arguments about whether some of the investigations into Trump were too much or too little or whatever. But that's not what this is about. They're just trying to obscure and hide and defend Trump by just letting him off the hook, because if he is held accountable in any way, that there's a Republican base that is still in thrall to him that will punish the people who hold him accountable, if they are Republicans especially. And Trump is clearly quite vindictive. And so it's really just cowardice and political, you know, desire to survive politically that's driving this.
Yeah, rather than any sense of duty, which thankfully some prosecutors and grand jurors and others are doing. And so that was another headline from this week, was that there's now a third audio recording that's been discovered of Trump trying to get people to overturn his election loss. According to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, there's a recording of a 2020 phone call between Trump and the then Speaker of the Georgia House of Representatives, in which Trump requests that Ralston convene a special session of the legislature to overturn Biden's election victory there. And now the speaker, he has since passed away, but he cut the president off and said that, you know, he just doesn't think that he can do that, which is also the kind of thing Robin Voss said in Wisconsin. But even though this guy in Georgia and Robin Voss, you know, didn't go so far as what Trump wanted, they still pass along the rhetoric. Voss hired Michael Gableman to waste a couple $1 million of Wisconsin money on investigations. And I mean, there's just no way. This is all just going to keep going until there is some level of accountability. Otherwise, this is the endless loop that we're caught in, because it's not like people are going to give up on wanting Trump to be accountable for trying to overturn an election.
No. And, you know, it's not as if the Republican Party has moved on from election denialism. Saw last year, the candidates who embraced it the most did the worst in competitive states and races. But the problem is, Trump isn't moving on from it. I think if you asked most Republican elected officials, they never want to talk about that again, with the exceptions of, you know, the most extreme ones. But Trump is not moving on because his ego won't allow him to. Like, he can't admit that he lost. And so everything for him is about relitigating that. And so that forces everyone else to relitigate it. And because there's a lot of people who are politically cowardly, they just keep on going with it. You know, Robin Voss and these other folks who may not have been 100% aboard, but were still kind of helping, you know, spin and give a pathway for this conspiracy to take hold, that they're still responsible. Just because they may not have bought in 100% doesn't mean they haven't done incalculable damage to people's trust in elections.
Well, and then the damage they've done quite physically and financially, the Trump administration. Now, this part isn't the criming part, it's just policy. But the deregulation of banking, the deregulation of the railroad industry, these are things that have caused actual harm, which, again, we bring up so that people notice that, yeah, there's politics, but there's also policy. And the decisions you make in policy can also do real damage to innocent bystanders.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, we've seen in the last couple of weeks and couple of months what deregulation can do. It can lead to disastrous train derailments that cause, you know, toxic chemicals to be spilled and burned. You know, it can lead to banks taking silly risks with the money of small businesses and, you know, individual folks. There are certainly regulations on the books that you could make a case for, you know, might be outdated. But in general, the 40, 50 year war on government regulations and rules has had horrific consequences for the average person, because it makes workplaces less safe. It makes communities less safe. It makes your money less safe. We saw in 2008 what happened, you know, and that was a result of deregulation under both Republicans and Democrats, to be frank. But it was Republicans driving the car. They are the ones who primarily pushed deregulation. And unfortunately, a handful of Democrats have been on board in the 90s and early 2000s, and even maybe more recently. But you are seeing a lot of Democrats now forcefully speak out. You know, there was a bill introduced to layer on new banking regulations in the wake of what's happened, you know, with Silicon Valley Bank in California and a few others that have had some issues. But yeah, ultimately, you know, the government exists to help people and to protect people. And part of that does involve regulations.
Career Newsroom national correspondent Kia Vakil, thanks so much. It was good to see you again. And we'll talk in 2 weeks.
Likewise. Thank you, Pat.
And still ahead, we will have weatherology meteorologist Jennifer Vichitsky. And we will talk to Mark Jacob, a former editor at the Chicago Tribune and Chicago Sun-Times, and Dan Schumacher, UW-Eau Claire athletic director, as we look ahead to the weekend sports events. And we'll have some sports headlines, including the Bucks playing last night as well. That plus a little music break and a history lesson in just a couple of minutes here on Up North News Radio for this St. Patrick's Day Friday. And all those I would accuse, please don't tell me about the news. Well, that, of course, is tequila, which I think on St. Patrick's Day, do you dye that green and shoot that as well?
I can't say that I've done that.
No, maybe we just invented something. You know, we've heard about dyeing beer green. Why wouldn't you do that with tequila or vodka? Or I'm just making myself ill thinking about it.
Yeah, I have done a green Russian.
A green Russian.
Just a white Russian with green food coloring.
The whole reason for playing tequila is it was the number one song on this day in 1958 by the Champs. So what is that, 65 years? 65 years ago today, the song Tequila is officially a senior citizen. Welcome, Tequila. This is also the anniversary of the birth of Nat King Cole. He was born Nathaniel Adams Cole on this day in 1919, 104 years ago. Oh, back to 1958. This was also the day that Johnny Mathis released the very first greatest hits album. I mean, greatest hits albums. There's been a gazillion of them, a compilation of all the songs that, you know, got to the top of the charts. But somebody had to have the very first one, and Johnny Mathis had the first greatest hits album this day in 1958, a trend that will likely stick around forever. Actor Rob Lowe is 59. Yeah, sorry, it's a new year. I hadn't worked on the math yet. Rob Lowe is 59 years old today. And Billy Corgan, frontman and songwriter for the Smashing Pumpkins, is 56. Claire Boucher, a.k.a. Grimes, is 35. Andrew Hosier Byrne. You go Hosier. I always get tripped up on Hoosiers from Indiana, but Hosier, right?
I Hosier? Don't totally know. I think it's Hosier, I think.
Hosier. we'll go with what's French. Regardless, he's 33 years old today. Back to music that's more in my groove. 1978, on this day, Jimmy Buffett released his eighth studio album, Son of a Sailor, including this little ditty. This, of course, would be Jimmy Buffett's Cheeseburger in Paradise. And trust me, starting at some point in the next 24 hours at an airport, I will be playing Jimmy Buffett endlessly in my earphones, including Son of a Sailor and Cheeseburger in Paradise. Again, released on this day, 1978. Son of a Sailor, it has just one of my favorite lyrics. It just simply says Southeast of Disorder. And I feel like that's been my compass point forever since I saw that is, you know, wherever I am, I appear to be Southeast of Disorder. On this day in 1984, Van Halen's album 1984 peaked at number 2, including Panama. You may be saying, why did Van Halen's 1984 peak at number 2? I mean, it was a blockbuster album for its time. Well, it was because of another album up there called Thriller by Michael Jackson. And so Van Halen, could never break through. Thriller had already spent 31 weeks on top of the chart by that point. However, it's worth noting Eddie Van Halen was up there along with it because he had performed the now legendary guitar solo on Beat It on the Thriller album. So Eddie Van Halen got to be number one and number two on the album charts this day in 1984. We haven't hit a lot of sports yet, so I wanted to give a quick update there. The Milwaukee Bucks were defeated last night. The Indiana Pacers rallied late, and they beat the Bucks 139 to 123 last night. Let's see. The Bucks still lead the Eastern Conference, and their next game will be at home versus Toronto on Sunday. Let's see. What else do we have here? Well, oh, yeah, of course, it's NCAA tournament time here. So we've got the Marquette men's basketball team playing against Vermont in Columbus, Ohio. That's this afternoon at 1:45 is when the NCAA tournament kicks off for them. The Marquette women are in the tournament as well, and they play this morning in Columbia, South Carolina against South Florida. And again, that's at 10:30 this morning. The Badger women's hockey team is in the NCAA Frozen Four, so they are in the national semifinal game. That is tonight. It's in Duluth, but it's against the University of Minnesota Golden Gophers. So although they're up at the home of UMD, that's simply because that's where the NCAA tournament is at. So the Badger women versus the University of Minnesota, the game will be in Duluth at 6 o'clock this evening. Now, getting back to it being St. Patrick's Day, our Up North News daily newsletter came out just about an hour ago. We usually send that thing out bright and early in the morning for you. Christina Laurie puts that together for us. And you know that occasionally we have a segment with her called The Uplift, where she brings us some of the more positive stories going on of the past few days. And she begins by talking about Wisconsin's very own leprechaun at SSM Health St. Mary's Hospital in Madison. For the past 20 years, a fellow named Joe Herr has dressed in head-to-toe green, going from room to room in the hospital, passing out green carnations and playing his trusty harmonica. And Christina goes on to tell us about how his son Logan was cared for at SSM. He had cerebral palsy. He died after catching pneumonia at the tender age of four. But ever since, he has dedicated himself to improving the quality of life for other families with children who are disabled. He started the Logan's Heart and Smiles Foundation, which builds wheelchair ramps for families in the Madison area. For any kind of a donation, Herr will appear at local businesses around St. Patrick's Day to spread a little luck and a lot of joy. And I can really connect with Joe Herr on this. He, again, losing his son who had cerebral palsy at a young age and spent a lot of time in the hospital. A lot of the same things happened with our family, with a younger brother of mine who was born with cerebral palsy and died at the age of nine, and again, spent all that time in the hospital. And it's one of those things that we just don't think about nearly enough, because it would gut a lot of us to know that at any given point, so many families are in hospitals with children who are fighting sometimes extremely uphill battles. And so for a fellow like this who lost his son, to still spend that much time in the hospital to care for other families, that in and of itself is about as uplifting as it gets, is knowing that, you know, this is somebody who is willing to look out for others despite, you know, the pain that he has had to bear as well. So take a look at that. Click on the link to learn more about it. To sign up for the newsletter, go to upnorthnewswi.com, click newsletter in the top banner. Also in today's newsletter, with another St. Pat's Day theme, some of the best places to get corned beef in every corner of the state. Wherever you click, you can find some of the best ways to celebrate St. Patrick's Day all around the area. So take a look at that and more. When we come back after a break for news, we will talk about the debate between Democrats and Republicans in Madison over what should be the right amount for bail. How should bail be set for people accused of crimes? And Republicans taking on the tough issue of what should be the state rifle. Next, you're up.